1, 2, 3, this is Dr. Alex Avila with Love University, and we're back. I'm an author, psychologist, and speaker. Every week we talk about how to love yourself, others, and a higher nature. How do you improve your life and your relationships, your career, your spiritual, emotional health? And we've been having some great guests, and today we have a very special guest I'm very excited to have on the show, and that is Stephen Tobolowsky. He's one of America's most beloved actors. USA Today called him the 9th most frequently seen actor in movies. He's appeared in over 200 films and many TV projects. Plays both comedic and dramatic roles. He's been nominated for a Tony Award. He played the annoying insurance agent Ned Ryerson in the classic movie Groundhog Day. He's been also in Memento, Mississippi Burning as a head of a Ku Klux Klan, Glee, Clown of Fornication, Silicon Valley. In addition, he's a musician, director, and author of many books, including The Dangerous Animals and My Adventures with God. Welcome, Stephen, to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Avila.
And what haven't you done, Stephen? Sounds like you do almost everything. Do you do juggling or anything else? Or
I don't do juggling, and I don't do waiting in line very well.
There you go. A little bit of that. Now, you were in this classic movie, Groundhog Day, and there's like a philosophical message I want to talk to you about and see what you think, where Bill Murray apparently was reliving his life every day, and nothing changed. So he was able to realize that there's no consequences, there's no tomorrow. So he started indulging his sensual appetites, food and sex, and even doing illegal things. And then he found that he was empty, he was unhappy, and he discovered that by giving love and helping people, that gave him meaning and a sense of love, and eventually the spell was snapped and he woke up next to the woman he loved. So how do you see that, Stephen? Is that something that can apply to our lives? Can we find the meaning in the everyday?
Yeah, I think one thing that's interesting is that the screenwriters of Groundhog Day tried to use Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's 5 Stages of Death and Dying as a template for it. And I believe the first is, I don't remember each one, but you know, there's acceptance, there's anger, there's defiance, all of those.
Yes.
So Bill Murray's character goes through each one of those. At first, he doesn't believe the situation he's in.
Yes.
Then he rebels against the situation he's in. Then he gradually becomes to accept it. And then as he accepts it, he realizes that what is more important than, as you point out, satisfying his appetites is trying to help people. And that in turn gives his life a lot of meaning. One thing that was cut from the movie, which I think is very interesting also for your listeners, is that when Bill Murray is in the diner in the middle of that movie, there is shelves of books in the background of the diner. And one of the motifs that was cut from the film to indicate the passage of time is that Bill starts from the first book of that library and begins to read it. And then there is a series of shots and he reads the entire library. I asked Harold Ramis, the director of the film, how long Bill was trapped in the town, because there are all sorts of theories. And Harold Ramis, who was a practicing Buddhist, said 10,000 years, because it takes 10,000 years, according to Buddhism, for the human soul to refine itself. And I bring up the books because not only did Bill try to satisfy himself by just with appetites, but tried to satisfy himself with trying to acquire all the knowledge he could, and that didn't work either.
Interesting. Well, you know, I was thinking, Stephen, the good part of that, I mean, in some ways, thinking you're invulnerable can actually help you vanquish fear, because I think he was on a railroad track and he was doing a lot of crazy things. But fear really holds us back a lot. So how do we apply this to our life? How can we vanquish fear by being able to live the day fully? You know, let's say today's your last day. Would you live with fear or without fear, Stephen?
Well, that's a great question, because fear can come on you very quickly and in an instant, and fear could vanish. And another thing, too, there's the echoes of fear in our life, kind of like ripples in a stream. Something will happen that has apparently no connection to your life, and suddenly you're overwhelmed with fear because it brings up a fear from your past, this memory. So I think what we have to do is, I think we have to embrace what can really happen to us. There's there's two kinds of situations we find that create fear. One is the fear in which we could do something about, i.e. we can prepare ourselves, we can get knowledge, we can fix our earthquake kit. You know, we could we could get new light bulbs for the flashlights and batteries. We can prepare ourselves for fear. But then there are the things that have no shape and have no word and no meaning. Mm-hmm. Those fears are more in the realm of the kind of nightmare in which we can't really describe what it is that's causing us fear, but it still paralyzes us. And those things we need to try to dismiss as best we can. And there are various ways people use to dismiss those.
Yes.
One is with good actions with other people, doing things for other people, like in Groundhog Day.
Right.
Another thing is prayer. Yes. Another thing is building our own personal strengths. And another thing is in the realm of therapy of saying, look at this. Is this something that really is going to hurt me now or not? No, then be gone. And using our will to get rid of those shapes that move in the dark. At least that's what it's been in my life.
Yes, that's very insightful, Stephen. So you're a lot more than an actor. It sounds like you're a very philosophical kind of guy, spiritual man. And I see the insights. But also, you know, Love University, we believe that love can also cast away fear. We hear that in many of the spiritual texts, that a perfect love, whether it's a higher power, God, nature, even sometimes someone you really love, can take away that fear. Now, the other thing, Stephen, is in terms of, you know, we have people that listen to the show that may even want to be actors. We're actually based in the Los Angeles area. And also worldwide. So how were you able to get that part? Is this something that you worked hard to get, or how did you get that the part of the insurance agent, which is a classic character?
Well, I would say this to your audience. It's the primary question of where do I begin?
Yes.
Where do I begin to answer that question? Do I say that I got the part because I got an agent? Or do I say I got the part because I wanted to be in plays in college and took acting courses? Or do I say I wanted to be an actor in high school? Or when I was 5 years old, I wanted to be in movies? Where do you begin with the impetus of how I did Groundhog Day?
Wow.
The only thing I can say is, per our previous discussion, is I went in, I read the script, and I thought it was wonderful. I read the part and thought it was wonderful, and I was afraid. And in terms of dealing with the fear, in this case, fear was a matter of being dispelled by preparation.
Yes.
I worked on the audition until I felt like I may not get the part, but this is the way I would play Ned, the insurance salesman. I felt Ned and I were one. And and for the people out there who are interested in auditioning or being actors, one way to dispel fear, and I'll give you two. The first way to dispel fear is to work for someone else. And in this case, it's your part. The audition is the one chance you have to give that little voice inside of you life. It's the one chance to say, you are a bird and I'm letting you free. And so in honor of that little voice inside of you, of that part, and in my case, Ned, in Groundhog Day, you let it free.
Yes.
But here's the second one. Here's the second one. And this was pretty profound mistake on my part. This was a big one. It was a different audition for a different show, television show, a 20th Century Fox. And when you do auditions of this sort for big jobs like Groundhog Day or for television shows, you don't get the part with one audition. You have to go to several auditions. And the final audition in television is what they call a network audition. So you audition first for the producers, then for the studio, then the network. And you are very scared when you go into the network audition.
I can imagine that.
I got the time wrong. I got the time wrong. And I ended up going to 20th Century Fox an hour and a half before my audition.
Okay.
So I walk into the large, large room where I'm going to audition, and I see the table where the executives are going to sit. I see the camera, the video camera to record my audition. I see the place where the audience, the executives, are going to be sitting behind the ones who are judging. And then I see my little chair in front of the camera, and I was terrified. Oh, wow. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, what is it about this setup that scares me to death? And I'm thinking, it's that camera pointed at me and that table behind the camera with the five chairs, the five empty chairs behind it sitting in judgment. And I sat in the room and I thought, what can I do to make myself less afraid in this situation? And this is what I did, Dr. Avila. I walked into the room. I grabbed my chair that was in front of the camera, and I moved it behind the table. So now there are six chairs behind the table, and suddenly I felt good. Now, I put the chair back. I put the chair back in front of the camera. I wasn't gonna screw with them with the audition, but the point was, as opposed to sitting in a place where I was being judged, I'd moved my chair to where I was a collaborator.
I like that. Yeah, in psychology, I work a lot with shy people who are self-conscious, and we call that the observer or self-observer is the self-conscious part of our mind, and then the actor is the spontaneous side that's more natural and free-flowing. So you did what we call the actor-observer reversal. You reverse yourself into more of the spontaneous part of you, the natural part.
And there you go.
And moved away from the self-conscious. Now, Stephen, the other thing is, I think a lot of people are curious, the personality of these great actors. You've worked with Bill Murray and probably a lot of other great actors, comedic, maybe even geniuses. Is that true, the so-called tortured genius? Do you see some of these people that have psychological issues? You know, even like, unfortunately, Robin Williams, our great actor who killed himself with manic depression. Is that a misnomer, or is that really true, the tortured genius?
Well, I think certainly many, many, many people who are creative, I don't know if I'd use just tortured genius, but they're far more sensitive to their own terrors than some people are. Some, you know, they said in the Middle Ages, for example, in the Middle Ages, the average person never traveled more than 5 miles from the place they were born.
Yes.
And now, in our current day, if you live in the Los Angeles area, you travel more than 5, 10, 15, 20 miles from where you live every day on the 405 to get anywhere.
Right.
And if you take a look at people who are creative, they're always reaching out, trying to get stimulus, inspiration, ideas from the world around them, as opposed to just working in a small radius around themselves.
Right.
And that experience of opening yourself up all the time beats you up. And another thing that beats you up is when you perform, performance is an adrenaline profession. It's a little like baseball, and it's a little like being a right fielder in baseball. You're standing there, nothing happens. Crack at the bat. Oh my gosh, it's coming my way. Adrenaline.
Yes.
Then you run. Then you jump. Then you try to keep the ball inside the park. Then you throw the ball into second base. And then you internally collapse.
Yes.
And whenever you're involved with an adrenaline profession, like acting, like singing, like writing, you have this rush of adrenaline and a crash. And the more you have that, the more you're likely to be depressed, to not think clearly, to have substance abuse, either with alcohol or drugs, to try to anesthetize yourself a little bit. So I think those two go together.
Yeah, I mean, some research even shows that so-called creative people, or even so-called geniuses, have a high level of mania, which is, you know, accelerated energy level, but then they can drop once they come from that high. But one thing that may help people ground themselves, I think this is something you've talked about a lot, is a spiritual nature, a spiritual practice. And Stephen, you have an amazing experience. You said that, I think back in 2008, you almost died. You broke your neck in five places, right? and then something happened to you. Tell us about that story that I think transformed your life.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. There's two miracles in this story. The first story was the fact that I lived. I broke five vertebrae in the central vertebra, the C4, as the doctors call it, in the neck, was crushed.
And by the way, Steve, why were you laughing? Most people think it's a tragedy. Why do you laugh at that?
Well, as I say, Dr. Avila, never trust a catastrophe because it could turn into a blessing before you know it.
I like that.
So, first of all, I was alive. I was grateful. And there wasn't much you could do with a broken neck.
Yes.
And so the first thing I did was I came up with this idea that one of the reasons, one thing that makes us feel good in life is if we can see life, our lives, as a form of addition. Whenever we're adding something or feel like we're adding something to our life, we feel whole and we feel content. In Hebrew, you know, the word kadosh means holy. Yeah, it means holy. It means also separate from what normally happens. And we look for that in our life. When we have some sort of addition, it feels separate and it makes us feel holy. Now, the negative, if we feel subtraction, look out. That's what happens, like as an actor, when you get fired. That's what happens when you don't get a part, when you go through a divorce, when you've lost a friend,
rejection.
When you've lost your keys, when you lose things, you feel your voice, your life is subtraction. And that diminishes you. So with a broken neck, I realized I was in a place of enormous subtraction.
Yes.
I was unable to work. I had to live off of my bank account. Money is draining out. I didn't know what I would be when the brace came off my neck. And so I tried to use my theory to find a way to make my life addition. And the one thing I could do, the one thing I could do for addition, and this is pathetic, but it's also heartening, is I could sit in a different place. I could sit in a place maybe I never sat before. And so I asked my wife, since I couldn't do anything really for myself, to help move a bench from the patio into the yard, into a place where I never sat before. And I wanted to see if it acted as addition. And it did.
Interesting.
I was able to see the rose garden from a different angle. I was able to hear the birds in the tree, see shadows and the sun move across the yard in a different way. And I began to feel more whole.
That's pretty good.
as it turned out, there was a squirrel in the yard that I called Al-Qaeda squirrel that did not like me sitting in my new seat. So Al-Qaeda squirrel started throwing missiles down at me, little baby avocados and pine cones at me. So I had to get my wife to keep moving my bench further and further and further back into the yard, further away from the house, further into the yard so I could get away from Al-Qaeda squirrel. And I'm sitting at the back of the yard, and in my vision, I see this flash of color, of purple and of gold and green. And I look up, and the back of the tree where Al-Qaeda squirrel was living was covered with parrots. Parrots I had never seen before, and I had no idea were here. And then I remembered 35 years before, when I came out to Los Angeles, there was a story of a fire in a pet store in Studio City. And the owner of the pet store saved the dogs and cats but couldn't save the birds. And he pulled the cages out and just opened them up. And apparently he released some of these parrots into the air, and the legend was that these parrots still lived somewhere in Studio City in the valley. Not only was the apocryphal true, the parrots were alive. They were living on the back of my tree, and I never would have known it if I didn't move my bench. So I start writing a commandment for myself. In times of grief, in times of fear, in times of subtraction, move your bench. So, and here's the punchline of the whole thing. At the very end of the 3.5 months of my neck healing, I get my first audition. It's for the TV show Glee.
Yes.
So I'm opening, I tell my agent, yes, I'm going to go in on this audition. Whether I'm ready or not, I'm going in because it's going to be audition by audition. So I'm reading the script. And I see a shadow moving over my head, over the script, and I don't even look up because I know from the shape of the shadow that it's one of the parrots flying overhead, coming back to roost in the tree. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's the way it is with all miracles. It's easy to recognize the shadow once you've seen the real thing. And I stop and I close my script and I stand up and I have that moment, Doctor, where I look across the yard and my yard is filled with sunlight and shadows. Wow. And I thought, what would happen if one of these shadows, which I always thought was part of the darkness before, is really nothing more than a miracle that's unobserved, like the parrots. And suddenly, this was the real miracle. My vision changed. In an instant, I began to see the miraculous all around me, and it completely changed my life.
That's amazing. That's an incredible story. And you're a great storyteller, Stephen. I can see how you paint pictures. I can see this. And the idea of the unobserved miracle, that's a beautiful concept, is that every day we probably have a lot of miracles around us, but we don't really see them because we're so caught up in our everyday worries and anxieties and things. But it takes something like that, you know, unfortunately breaking a neck, I mean, or whatever catastrophe can be turned into something beautiful.
Absolutely.
And then, Stephen, then you apparently started writing books. And you wrote a beautiful book called My Adventures with God, in which you look at the five books of the Old Testament, the Torah, and you talk about the stages of people's lives. And you also write about, I guess, Genesis, the creation stage. How does a Genesis work for the everyday person?
Well, I see Genesis as kind of what we usually tell people on a first date with the first glass of Chardonnay, of who we are, where we came from, what our family is, what our aspirations are. And if the date is going well, we usually share what our terrors are. And that is the book of Genesis. You know, that is the story of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the family unit and what we wish to achieve and what terrifies us.
I see. Because, you know, the idea of stories we hear a lot in certain authors, you may have heard of Don Miguel Ruiz, who wrote The Four Agreements. He said that we actually sometimes tell stories to ourselves, but that are negative stories. For example, our parents told us we're not good enough, worthy enough, smart enough, or lovable enough, and then we carry these stories into adulthood. So how do we separate the good stories versus the bad stories in our life?
I guess, we have to learn to separate opinion from fact, and we have to learn to separate who's on our side and who's not. Yeah. I had many naysayers in my life, many people who said, you can't do this, you can't do that. But then I had to think, well, maybe they're incorrect. Maybe they were always incorrect, and not because they were bad or stupid or had bad intentions. Maybe they just didn't have all of the information. And that's one thing, Dr. Avila, I tell myself all the time. Thank goodness for ignorance, because it gives us an out that we just didn't know all the facts going into it.
Yes.
I was reading one book from the Middle Ages. It's a Christian supporting text called Piers the Plowman. And it really moved me in a way, in that the motif of the book is the line, judge not, lest ye shall be judged.
Yes.
And what it says in Piers the Plowman is that the main reason you should not judge is that you don't know. You just don't know all the facts.
Right.
And that little line has stayed with me my entire life. When someone has told me, oh, you're not good enough.
Right.
And I just think, well, they don't have all the facts. They don't know all my skills. They don't know all the things I'm capable of doing. I don't even know all the things I'm capable of doing.
Yes.
And so it's up to us. It's an indulgence. And I'll be mean to the audience.
Yes.
It's an indulgence to believe all the bad things about yourself. It's a lazy way out. And you have to not be lazy. You have to be truthful. And you have to go, you know, maybe they're not right. Maybe I have a lot more on the ball than I gave myself credit for. I need to work a little harder.
Yeah, I like that. That's the idea of perspective, moving outside from the negative inner perspective to something higher that we don't even realize. And the other thing, Stephen, in Genesis, they talk about the special day of rest, which is the Sabbath or Shabbat. I know you're of the Jewish tradition where you take the day for holiness. And in our society, that's hard for people because we're kind of a technologically 24-hour-a-day workaholic society. And the Rabbi Heschel said, 6 days a week, we wrestle with the world, bringing profit. On the Sabbath, we care for the seed of eternity planted in the soul. 6 days a week, we seek to dominate the world. On the seventh, we try to dominate the self. And hey, remember that? And then Psalm says, Lord, make me lie down in green pastures. Lead me beside quiet waters. It seems like we have to be led or even forced to take a day off. So what's going on in our society, Stephen? Is that a problem that people just don't take that special spiritual time?
It's a huge problem. And I think it's these. It is, if you tackle that one problem, you will be much, much happier. Now, here's a confession to make.
Okay.
On my Sabbath, in my life, I only had one complete Sabbath. Okay. And it was accidental. I was on my book tour with My Adventures with God.
Yes.
I was in Woodstock, New York, and they put my wife and I up at a little cabin by a river.
Yes.
And the cabin had, oh God, this is so scary to even say it. The cabin had no Wi-Fi.
Oh.
And we didn't know it. Okay. So we were out there, and Friday night came, and the lights came down in the cabin. There was no computer. There was no nothing. And Saturday, all my wife and I had was to sit with each other, to talk with each other, and hear the water running beside us. Mm. And Lord Almighty, did it restore my soul. Ah. Lord Almighty, did it fulfill me. I just came right now from 3 weeks in Finland, where I had no Wi-Fi.
Yes.
And I spent a lot of time in the forest. And let me tell you, there is nothing to be gained by always being connected to the computer and to your email. And nothing of significance is going to happen by not knowing that news. I found my entire body slowed down. And rather than becoming more stupid than I already am, I found I slowed down, and the depth and breadth and beauty of the world and my life in the world became a part of me. And this last 3 weeks has been so enriching, not being connected to the idiotic computers.
Yes, I see that. And we talk about having a technology fast on our show. You know, we tell listeners, you know, take a half day or even more. Of course, technology does have a lot of advantages. I mean, the millennials and other generations believe that, you know, they can have more opportunity for work and relationships as a result. So there's some positives. But I think the key is slavery. And now we talk about Exodus, where they let them out of the slavery from the Egyptians. So what are we slaves to today? You know, technology could be one, maybe pleasure.
You got it, man. The iPhone, iPhone, the iPad, Facebook, Twitter, all of that junk we are slave to that. We are slave to the notions you brought up before of people putting limitations on us, telling us we're not good, we're not good enough.
Right.
We're enslaved to those ideas. It's like the things we are a slave to. Here's another thing we're a slave to.
Yes.
Like, I don't want to poo-poo it, but like people going to college forever. It's like when I graduate, of course, I graduated with a BFA. I mean, you know, what are you going to do with the BFA?
Yes.
Like nothing. But, you know, I know a lot of kids nowadays that don't get out of school until they're in their
30s. Yeah, that's kind
of crazy.
And
then what do they have? They've used one-third, more than one-third of their good part of their life to be cloaked in academia, and they really have nothing to show for it at the end of it.
Right.
And you trade grades, and I'll tell you one thing. People mistake victory for winning. Ah. They think, like, getting good grades, I win.
Right.
I get good grades, I'm going to be a good student. That is not the same as victory.
Exactly.
Victory includes loss. Victory includes sacrifice. Victory includes work. And there's nothing more rewarding than victory. And we don't feel victory unless we get away from slavery, the different things that enslave us, and yes. don't forget just the common ones of drugs and alcohol.
Right. And also, you know, maybe incompatible or abusive relationships or believing that you don't deserve to have the business or career you want. So, Stephen, how do we, now here's the key, how do we escape from slavery? Do we need to find an external mentor like a Moses, or do we have to need to find an internal Moses within that can liberate us? How do we do that?
I think both. I think also beware of the external Moses. You know, one of the reasons that they were very careful not to discuss Moses' family too much in the Torah,
yes.
because they did not want there to be a cult of Moses.
Wow.
And it is very, human beings are very easy to like just jump in line
yes.
to be the follower behind somebody. That's how you end up with Jonestown.
Yeah.
That's how you end up with all sorts of false prophets.
Right.
So I would say you definitely have to find the liberation inside. You have to find the voice inside of you that yeah. says, this is what I need to do. Even if it seems illogical, this is what I need to do. This is what I need to research. This is like you want to take me as an actor, for example.
Yes.
I was in school. I was working on a master's degree. I had done 1 year of the master's degree. And then I quit. And I said, what am I doing with my life?
Mm-hmm.
I got to go to Los Angeles and try to be an actor.
Ah.
I'm spending my life trying to get out of college.
Yes.
And if I don't get out of here, mm-hmm. the only thing I'm going to have is a master's degree, and I won't be able to get out of high school. That's all I'll be able to do is teach high school.
Yes.
So
you listen to your inner intuition and I guess yes. Your inner passion, and that led you. Now, the other thing is you talk about Leviticus, Stephen,
yep.
which is you call it the reconcile who you really are. Now, is this like kind of a midlife kind of realization? Is it a certain moment of knowing who you are? What does this mean to you, Leviticus?
I think so. I think it is a midlife changing course correction. Going back to my idea of victory versus winning, there is a lot of suffering involved in our lives. My son, William, is studying to be a doctor, and he said he understands the value of pain. He sees patients and he sees pain
yes.
as a warning to us and something is wrong, as an alarm. He says, but I don't understand suffering. And I said, here is suffering. Suffering is the only measure we have over what we love and what we care for. When suffering becomes too great, we drop things.
Mm-hmm.
But we hang on to identity and to the things we love, even through suffering. And that is what Leviticus is all about. After all of our failures and all the people telling us in our early lives, you can't do it, you can't do it, you're never going to find love, this isn't going to happen, this isn't going to happen. All of that creates suffering. And out of that comes an internal voice that says, wait a minute, universe, stop. This is what I am. And that is what Leviticus is. What I remember, I was in my confirmation class in Sunday school, and that was, kind of like junior high-ish age in Judaism. And my teachers said, like, what is your favorite book of the Torah? Well,
yes.
everybody's going to say Exodus. I mean, it's got Moses,
yes.
got
right.
the Ten Commandments, got the plagues, got everything, it's got everything. And I raised my hand and I said, Leviticus. And my teacher said, Leviticus? Why Leviticus? I said, because it's written in a different language. Genesis and Exodus are written in the language of people who want to be. Leviticus is written in the language of people that are here to stay. And that is what impresses me about Leviticus. And that is what that midlife change is, of where you take power over your life and you go, this is what I'm doing.
Yes.
You control your space.
Yes. The other thing in Leviticus talks about offering and sacrifice for a purity and a higher purpose, but a lot of people don't like to sacrifice. You know, sacrificing could mean giving up bad relationships or even self-defeating thoughts and habits. We had a psychologist that was very well-known, Firestone, that talks about voice therapy, how we have these, you know, inner voices that are critical, but they become almost like our friends. It's hard to get rid of them. So how do we sacrifice these bad things in our life that seem comfortable?
How do we sacrifice the bad things in our life that become comfortable?
Yes.
Sometimes you make a decision. Sometimes the decision makes you. Sometimes that's one great thing a vacation does. If you put yourself, I think, first of all, always putting yourself in nature helps. When you go into nature, you reset your clock and you do those sort of things. That helps you do it. Also, I don't know if you have this rule for your closet, but my wife is enforcing this rule in our house.
Yes.
If you don't wear a shirt in 2 years, uh-oh, it's gone. It's gone, man. Okay. It's out of here.
Eliminate the junk is what you're saying. Eliminate the things that don't no longer work.
If you're not using it, you've changed. Move on. It's not going
to
fit you anyway.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Yes.
You got to get rid of it. You got to get rid of that stuff.
Get rid of the junk.
Yeah. So putting yourself in situations that are not easy for you, ease, again, is part of winning, but it's not part of victory. I remember when I was a kid, I got my brother's hand-me-down bike, which I loved so much. It was so beautiful. But all my friends told me, no, that's an old-fashioned bike. That's a Schwinn. That's no good. You need a bike with gears. Nowadays, we have bikes with gears. That's the only way you're going to be able to ride up the hills, and you need a new bike. So I parked my brother's beautiful, beautiful bike in the garage, and I told Santa Claus I needed a bike with gears, and I got one. And the thing I found out about the bike with gears, it did make the hill easier, but when easy becomes your goal, it's never easy enough. And I was dissatisfied. I regret, you know, you learn those lessons that ease is not what you want. And a lot of times we make our decisions based on ease, based upon making what we love come true.
Exactly. Now, then we get, Stephen, to numbers, and we talk about mortality and grief. You know, my dad died a few years ago. I realized that death is real, you know, that we are mortal. And then the way to get around that, apparently, is having faith. And I think in the Israelites, they lost faith for a period of time, and then they're able to regain it. So, and you say that basically the faith is the courage to make the journey and ask questions that, without knowing the answers. And that's very important. So tell me more about that. You know, how does faith help us deal with, you know, the people dying in our life and losing relationships and losing their finances and setbacks? Because you said you've been through a triple bypass surgery. You've had a gun held to your head for 45 minutes. And then you had
more than 45 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Held to my head for, I was blabbering for 45 minutes, but I had held to my head for a couple of hours.
Wow. You're not talking about a movie. This is like a movie that you've been in, but this is a real life, you're saying, right?
Real life. In a grocery store, a man put a gun to my head and he was going to kill me. And the only way I could get out of it was by blabbering. Again, I blabbered for at least 45 minutes. And then the only way I could get out of it was to invite the guy over for dinner.
That's
as ridiculous as it seems.
Well,
yes.
You know, it's like in Psalms, they say, prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. So you're like having a banquet in some way psychologically, you know, mentally, in the face of death. So how do you do that? How do you maintain that incredible faith in the face of so much adversity?
I think... I like that you brought up, you know, numbers and mortality, and that you say that death became real for you.
Yes.
And for me, it was with my mother. And then, yes, that's exactly the way I would put
it,
that mortality became real. And when you really understand, I don't know that you really metabolize it, but when you really understand how limited your time is,
yes,
that you become more dependent on your faith, more dependent on faith as a motivator, as a lifeline, as a protection against, in concert with, not against, but in concert with mortality.
Yes.
You have to realize that mortality is the wake-up call that says, you know, you don't have all day to do this.
Yes.
So why not do it today and not tomorrow? And it's a great motivator.
Yes, definitely. And then finally, Deuteronomy is to, I think, like a legacy, to tell the stories to your children and grandchildren. Is that important for people to leave a legacy? Or some people may say, well, I just want to live a life and I don't really care about legacies.
No, it's important to tell the story to your children. I believe I mentioned in Genesis or Exodus back there, the word kadosh, meaning that which is separate. But in the Bible, they translate kadosh as holy. The word kadosh is holy, yes. Something that is separate. When you tell a story to your children, you are not telling an encyclopedic, truthful version of everything that happened at a certain event of when you were held hostage at gunpoint in a grocery store, broke your neck. No, you pick and choose the facts you tell and the facts you don't tell. And that's what makes the story separate from reality. That means they are holy. Yes. These stories that we tell our children become our holy books, become our mythology, and they, in fact, can inspire a child to faith.
That's powerful. Yes.
I got to tell you, there is, when I had, oh God, this is terrible. When I had my heart surgery,
yes,
which is, of course, very traumatic,
of course.
I had an event which was very difficult to explain. And they used, I guess, the same drug on me that they used on Michael Jack. It paralyzes you.
Wow.
And I heard the voice of my wife and two of my friends in the ICU, and they saw my eyelashes flutter as I was waking up. I went into surgery at 6 a.m. I'm coming out at 2 p.m.
Wow.
And I know it because there was this digital clock on the wall, 2 p.m. And the anesthesiologist told me that when I woke up, I will have tubes down my throat, and whatever I do, don't talk.
Wow.
Don't try to talk. Don't try to tell people you're all right, because you won't be able to and you'll choke. Anyway, I hear these voices and I wanted to say, I'm all right. I hear you. Thank you for being here. And I tried to speak and I couldn't. The tubes are down my throat.
Yes.
I began to choke. I hear alarms. I couldn't breathe. I hear alarms going off around beside me. I hear footsteps running. There's nothing I could do. I can't breathe. I can't do anything. And I look at the clock, and the clock on the wall says 2 p.m.
Yes.
And a voice comes in my ear, and it's the anesthesiologist. And he says, Stephen, don't breathe. We're breathing for you. The machine's breathing for you. Calm down. We're going to take the tubes out. As soon as you calm down, it should only be another 15 or 20 minutes. And I look at the clock, and I'm looking 2 o'clock, and the clock never changes. The clock stays still, 2 o'clock, and I can't breathe, and I'm looking out, and it's always 2 o'clock, and I don't know how long I was there. I realized there was no way I could live by looking out. The only way I could live was by looking in. And I went and I found this little spot inside of me where I could be and I could live and I could breathe. And I just focused on that one spot, not on a horizon, not on the distance, not on anything. And slowly the clock started changing. Once I found that spot, it was 4 hours before they took the tubes out of my throat. It was 6 p.m. before it, but for those 4 hours, I was disconnected from time. I never would have been able to live by looking out. The only way I could live was by looking in.
Wow, this is amazingly powerful. So you had your own little Groundhog Day experience. You were frozen there for a minute.
Then,
the phrase, we're breathing for you, is almost like saying there's a higher power out there. There's even God that is breathing for you, and that you kind of just need to relax, you know, and let that power take over and help you, you know, become the best you can be. So that's an amazing miracle. Stephen, it's great to have you on board. I mean, you are a very spiritual and philosophical guy. You know, I would never see, you know, looking at your comedic role, I said, this is a funny guy. So how did you get so spiritual? I mean, this is kind of cool. You got into the whole.
I don't know. I always had a strong belief in God. I always read the Bible, and you know, it was one of those things, if it was something in the Bible that I didn't understand, I didn't assume that it was because the Bible was idiotic. I began to assume, well, maybe you need to think about it a little more, and you need to think about what this really means. And so that was kind of the key to my spirituality. But I think everybody kind of finds their own way, and yes, other people find right. ways through drugs and alcohol, which right. is their version of trying to reach a more secluded place. But yes, it is no answer.
Right. It's a higher place, but it may not be the best for them.
No.
Now, give me a couple of quick takes, because I know you're probably very good at improv, improvisational things. So, for example, Stephen, what kind of superhero would you be? What power would you have?
When I was a superhero, you know, the superhero I always liked when I was growing up was the Flash.
Oh.
Because he was so fast.
Yes.
He could vibrate so fast that he could change the physical world around him.
Ah.
He could avoid trouble by avoiding it as opposed to confronting it.
Ah.
So I think the Flash, that would be me.
So Flash instead of the Hulk. You don't want to have to be the big tough guy that beats people up.
The Hulk? No, I couldn't do the Hulk.
Yeah, I know. How about what is your greatest accomplishment in life, or life lesson that you have?
Greatest accomplishment. Oh, that I'm still here. That's a great accomplishment.
Yes.
I think one of the greatest moments I had as an actor is none of the films or television shows or awards or anything like that. But when I first came out to Los Angeles, I was doing children's theater. And we went to a school in San Francisco where there were race riots, and two of the kids were hospitalized. I heard they were killed. I don't know, but they were hospitalized. They didn't cancel our little show, which was about loving one another, which is about giving each other respect. Mm-hmm. We entered the school under a police escort.
Wow.
And we went up and we started doing our show. I was playing the guitar. We were singing our songs and doing our little skits. Kids were throwing stuff at us, shouting us down, throwing full cans of Coke. And let me tell you, not empty Coke cans, but if a full can of Coke hits you, you're in trouble. So we did our show, our 45-minute show. Halfway through the show, we continued in spite of everything. And the audience began to change.
Wow.
And when we got to the end of the show, the kids began screaming and applauding, stood up, and we left the stage, but they kept clapping. So we came out and we bowed again, and we left, and we got a note from the superintendent of schools there saying that however we did it, we ended the riots at the school, and there was peace in the school now.
That's amazing.
It's what I consider one of my proudest moments, but I think what it shows was we endured. We kept going even though everyone around us was shouting us down. We kept going with our message of inclusivity, of love, of respect. And eventually, people believed us and they listened.
Yes.
And
you turned them around, right? You transformed them, in a sense.
Reigned. That is correct.
That's beautiful. Now, how about your greatest fear?
Greatest fear. Oh, man. The problem with greatest fear, Dr. Avila, is it's a shapeshifter. Great fears are shapeshifters, and they keep changing. So one of the great writers of the studiers of the Torah, his name was Hillel. He lived at the time, basically, of Jesus, about, you know, 0 AD, about the same time.
Yes.
When he was a boy, he wanted to study, but he was poor and only the rich could go to school. And so Hillel, who was tending the sheep, crawled up on the roof of the schoolhouse so he could hear the lessons inside, even though he wasn't allowed inside. And a storm came up and he was caught and froze. He was hit by a storm outside. It was freezing. And the teacher heard the noise on the roof and brought Hillel in and put him by the fire and said, this is how much we should want to learn. He will always be welcome in this school.
Wow.
Hillel said, as one of his teachings when he grew up to be a man, and one of the greatest scholars of Judaism, he said, never trust yourself until the end of your life. And I find that is the thing to deal with fear. Never trust yourself, because fear will find a way in. Fear will find a way to take you down. You have to always be on guard. Hmm. And that is what makes you stronger. And that is what gives you victory.
I see. But was there a fear that you overcame personally that you can tell us about?
Gosh, there's so many different shapes. Like fear of losing love. Yeah. There is fear of failing in my profession.
Yes. And how did you overcome that? Did you, through the spiritual faith?
I don't know. I don't know that I did, I guess is what I'm saying. I'm saying I overcame I won the battle, but the war continues because the fear emerges in a different shape. It requires constant faith.
Yes.
Constant vigilance because I think, here's something I think along the lines of what you're asking.
Yeah.
I was fired from a television show and it hurt me very deeply.
Yeah.
And it happened kind of like all those things happen in a very underhanded sort of way. And the people did it in a way to protect themselves and certainly not to protect me. Mm. And I was crushed. But I found out, this was big, 2 weeks later, I was okay. I felt miserable.
The show was canceled too, or no?
No. The show was successful without me. But, that went on without me. But there were other people that ended up being fired too.
Yes.
But I, after 2 weeks, the pain was not constant. The pain was not every day. It didn't haunt my dreams. It didn't keep me awake at night.
Right.
And I thought, well, if I can go through this awful, horrible, the worst thing I could possibly imagine in my profession, business, and have the pain only last 2 weeks.
Yes.
I could do that. I could handle that.
Yeah.
And so just knowing that the pain of failure doesn't last the rest of your life. Gosh. 2 weeks in my case.
Yeah, exactly.
You could deal with it.
Well, Stephen, as I hear you, being so kind of philosophical, spiritual, and kind of a kind-hearted man, I can visualize you playing the president of the United States. Would you like to do that role someday? Be a president?
That role is way too hard.
Oh, really? You have a presidential look, I think, right? You're kind of...
First of all, I'm not a huge fan of politics. I think if I were to play anything in the political realm, I think, let me just play a...
Councilman?
Yeah, a judge. I'll be a judge.
Okay, you'd be a compassionate judge, right? That gives them a second chance.
I'll be a judge. I can be compassionate as a judge.
But also tough, right, if you need to be.
That's right.
And what are your, I guess, looking down the future, what are you excited about, Steve, in terms of your career? Do you have any shows coming up, any books you're doing? What is it that our listeners can really look forward to?
I'm working on a new book now about, I'm calling it, it may change, The Story of the Moment.
Yes.
And that is, I think all of us really are framed by one or two moments in our life. It isn't like this broad scope of things that make us. I think we gravitate toward one or two moments that defined who we were. And I write a book of stories to try to find what those moments were in my life.
And I'm
working on that book now. And right now, we have our fingers crossed. I've been involved with the show One Day at a Time, which is a beautiful show. We have 3 years of it on Netflix if you want to watch it. It is a great, great, funny show, very moving show, One Day at a Time. And it was not picked up for a fourth season by Netflix. However, we have some studios that are interested in maybe taking it away from Netflix and bringing it back to life. So we have a story of resurrection happening here. Mm-hmm. And so I have my fingers crossed, my toes crossed, and we'll see, because I've been in a lot of shows, as you mentioned, and very few of them are as good as One Day at a Time. So hopefully there's room in the world for a little more One Day at a Time.
Right. And plus, our philosophy, One Day at a Time, that's a great way to look at life. Give love and joy and help people one day at a time.
Absolutely.
And like you said, add to your life every day. Add a little something better. Stephen, it's been a great joy to have you on the show. This has been one of our most comprehensive shows. And is there any way that people can either write to you? Do you have any website or anything people can see what you do?
You can write me. I'm going to give you my email, and I'll spell it for you, because if you spell it wrong, you end up at a naked site. It's like... Stephen Tobolowsky @gmail.com, and that's Stephen, T as in Tom, O, B as in boy, O, L, O, W, S-K-Y. Y, that's the Russian spelling, not yes. I, Y. Yes. I so StephenTobolowski@gmail.com. Write me there and I'll write you back.
Perfect. And then your website is the same, Stephen Tobolowski?
StephenTobolowski.com. That'll Perfect. Have my podcast. That'll have my books and movies. And also on Twitter, I'm at Tobolowski.
Yes.
And on Facebook, I'm Stephen Tobolowski. You can find me there. And yes. My podcast is called The Tobolowski Files.
Oh, perfect.
It's been on NPR, and it's been all over the world now. And I have about 86 hours of stories
wow.
there, and I'm writing more that'll come out this year. And what I do is I do true stories from my life, and hopefully some of them have a point.
Wow. Well, Stephen, we'd love to have you back on the show, or maybe we can collaborate on some projects and help people, basically in these kind of ideas you're talking about, spirituality, love, and also forgiveness is very important. I think we can talk for a long time, Stephen. You're a great guy to talk to. You're a storyteller. I can see why the guy didn't shoot you in the head, because you kept him entertained.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, so that's quite wonderful. So again, Love University students, this is Dr. Alex Avila. If you want to write us about the show today, write us at loveuniversity@gmail.com. Visit us at loveuniversity.love. Like us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. So again, Stephen, thank you very much for being on the show. It's been a pleasure to have you. And Love University students, put away your notebooks, your iPads, your phones, and go out and have a very loving and powerful week this week, utilizing all of these ideas we came up with today. Until next time, Dr. Avila, Love University.